Welcome to a Prevent Connect audio conference recording. The following was recorded on May 22nd at a Call to Men's 2009 Annual National Conference in New York City, New York. To learn more about A Call to Men, visit their website at www.acalltomen.org.
Lundy, Bancroft, many of you know, when we do this work, we have to also look at the intersection between the abuse of women, their connection with their children, and the divisive ways in which both the child protective and court systems interfere with women's ability to gain and maintain custody of their children. And what that means when you add in that mix of abuse against by their partners and by the fathers of those children. So Lundy has spent the better part of his career dealing with exactly that issue. So I'd like to ask Lundy to come up, and he's going to take us to lunch and talk to us about that intersection.
So I start to feel like I'm looking at sort of a buffet of different kinds of atrocities against women, and I can't say there's one atrocity that's the ultimate. You could say, well, murdering the woman, that's the ultimate atrocity. Well, we heard about things this morning from Eve Ensler where it could be worse than murdering the person, and so there is no ultimate. So there are many ultimates. And I feel like when a loving, caring mother gets her children taken away from her, that's one of those ultimates. And that's one of the really heartbreaking, deeply violent, atrocious forms that the oppression of women takes. And the taking of women's children away from caring, responsible moms is heavily driven by violent men, by men who are already violent and abusive towards women, and they are some of the ones that are now creating an entire system, a psychological system, a legal system, a court system, an ideological system that's making it possible for abusers to take, to drive moms and their children apart. How many of you have, whether personally or professionally, somehow been close to a case where an abuser has taken a woman's children away from her? Look around for a minute, folks. Look around at how many hands are up in this room. Look, thank you. Look how common that is. This has become very, very widespread, and I'm going to say a little bit about why I believe that is. But what I want to emphasize first is that in my 20 years that I've been working with domestic violence, and I've been listening to women tell me their stories of being beaten, of having weapons held to their throats, of being trapped in rooms, of being threatened with being set on fire, with ending up in the hospital, with being sexually assaulted in various ways, I still have to say that the greatest anguish that I hear in the voices of women that I come into in my line of work is the woman who's calling me to tell me that either her children are on the verge of being taken away from her or they have already been taken away from her because a judge is deciding that these kids would be better off with their abusive father. And very often the judge is being supported in that decision by powerful and influential attorneys, psychologists, other human service professionals who are providing evaluations, who are providing an ideological argument for why these kids can be taken away and given to a man who was violent towards their mother, and very often a man who has been violent or sexually abusive to those kids as well. But you know, on another level, the fact that he's been violent towards their mother should be reason enough. We shouldn't have to prove, well, what kind of damage has he done to those kids. There are many misconceptions about the relationship between child custody and male domination, and I'm going to give a 3-minute version of what's a much longer discussion. But first of all, to this day, you still hear people say, well, moms have a tremendous advantage in a custody dispute. Well, that's been gone for 30 years. We're taking a long, long time, at least 30 years, we're taking a long time to wake up to the fact that the custody pendulum has swung the other way and that we now live in a time when if fathers contest custody, they are in a much better position than a mother who's contesting custody, by and large. And there are exceptions to that, and I'll talk about a couple of the exceptions, but by and large, that's the situation. The period of years in which mothers had an advantage in custody was, in historical terms, actually quite brief. Because up until the late 1800s, mothers simply didn't have any rights to custody. Children were simply the personal possessions of the father, and if the relationship broke up, the father could have custody, or he could even assign custody to someone else. He didn't even have to take it himself in order to take it away from her. He could say, no, my aunt's going to raise those children, my sister's going to raise those children, whatever he decided. The notion that a mother even had any right to custody of her own children didn't come until the late 1800s. It didn't get strong legally until the early 1900s. So when you hear about the maternal preference or the tender years doctrine, it didn't last that long. It lasted from, depending on what state, what court, and so forth, something like 1900 to something like 1965 or 1970, and then it faded fast during the 70s as the father supremacists started to learn and abusers started to learn how to use, ironically, the language of gender equality and of the latest wave of feminism, learn to use it to hurt women with. The situation in the present is one where male domination is firmly back in place. And why would we expect it to be otherwise? I mean, understanding the extent of male domination of the legal system, of the makers of laws, of how lawyers are taught to think, of how psychologists are taught to think. Why were there these decades when women had such an advantage in winning custody? Because there were a lot of decades there when men were really fine having them do it. But as soon as male domination-oriented men, as soon as male supremacists got wind again of what was happening, it swung right back the other way. And here's what I believe happened. I believe that over the course of the 60s and 70s, some key elements of men's ability to rule, to be fascists in their households, slipped away. Because of the women's movement, because of the advances in women's rights, because of the advances in domestic violence enforcement, there started to actually in the 70s and 80s begin to be some meaningful laws, and by the early 90s starting to be some enforceable laws against men terrorizing women in the home, the men start to feel their power slipping. And children have become the last stand. It's like, this is how, the thinking among those men is, this is how we're going to keep the power from slipping away from us. We're going to own and control children, and that's going to be where we're going to dig in. This is going to be our turf. This is how we're going to keep this from slipping away. And it's from that the father supremacy movement has been born and developed the kind of strength that it now has. What a woman faces when she goes into the court system, first of all, she tends to believe, well, the system wants me to leave the abuser, right? I'd be a bad mother. The system is telling me I'd be a bad mother if I stay with a batterer. In fact, in the current atmosphere, women who stay with abusers, even if they're staying there to save their lives, are just slammed by child welfare systems across the country. You're a bad mother for staying with this man. So she thinks, okay, they seem to want me to leave him. I'm not sure that's safe. I'm not sure it's the best thing for me or my kids, but they want me to leave him. Okay, I guess I should leave him. And suddenly she's slammed for trying to protect her kids from him. In other words, she's told she's a bad mother for exposing her children to him while they're together. And then as soon as they split up, suddenly the society does a complete about face and says, no, you're a bad mother for not wanting to expose your children to this man. Is he a different man now? This is exactly the same abuser that we had 2 years ago when they were together, but suddenly they're apart. And now, if she's reluctant to send her children into unsupervised contact with this man whose violence she knows well, she's told that she's guilty of parental alienation, she's told that she's a vindictive mother, that she can't let go of the past, that she doesn't believe that people can change, that she's hysterical. It all turns on her. An abused woman faces an adversarial system. Our whole legal system is set up for two people to fight against each other. It's not set up to seek the truth in a cooperative or reasonable or investigative communitarian kind of way. It's you two fight it out and we'll judge who wins. Well, in that kind of context, who's going to thrive, a batterer or a battered woman? For whom is that whole way of proceeding designed to succeed? She's going to face lack of resources. And a batter is almost always going to be in a better financial position than she is after the couple has split up. She's going to face a court mindset that thinks she's ridiculous, that's profoundly sexist. We have continuing to have research showing, for example, that testimony by females is believed less than testimony by males in court cases. A court mindset that says we should keep both parents involved no matter what kind of destruction they're doing to their kids. Although you'll notice that they suddenly, when it comes to keeping moms away from their kids, suddenly that switches around. The mom faces a court system where there's corruption, where there are often people doing each other a lot of favors behind the scenes, where people are playing golf together, where people are contributing to each other's organizations, where people are constant sources of work for each other. In other words, a lawyer, a custody evaluator knows, well, if I tell these people what they want to hear, then they're going to give me more, then they're going to give me more assignments. A woman faces the psychological establishment, and it's very important, I think, to understand that although psychological concepts can be a liberating force, the psychological field, the psychological establishment, has not been a progressive force. Although you can say, well, Freud is long ago and nobody believes Freud anymore, that's really not so. The Freudian mentality is still the underpinning of modern psychology. It still carries a lot of weight. And at the root of Freud's thinking is women and children make up claims that men are doing bad things to them. That's actually what the Oedipus complex was designed to explain. Was why women and children believe they've been sexually violated by men, when actually it hasn't happened. They've imagined it. That's the basis of modern psychology. And psychological testing was designed to figure out what's wrong with women. That's what psychological tests are designed to do. So if you put a batterer and a battered woman in a custody dispute and you give them psychological tests, which is what judges always want to do, those tests are going to find lots of things wrong with the woman and not very much wrong with the man. That's how those are going to work. She's going to face additional challenges based on her race and her class. If she's a woman of color, she's going to face the discrimination from the system, particularly if the batterer is not a man of color. If the batterer is a man of color, sometimes, she shouldn't bet her life on it, but sometimes racism will actually work in her favor because white judges sometimes want to be the protectors of women of color against those bad men of color. I'm not saying it's a good mindset, it's a bad mindset, but I've seen that sometimes keep a woman of color from getting creamed in a custody dispute. If her batterer is a white man, these are where I hear some of my worst stories of what happens in child custody, a woman of color against a white batterer. But who wins in court also just has so much to do with who has what kind of money. So the class issues there are huge. And who has what kind of connections and who's in with who. Then she also has to face the rage of male supremacist men and the rage of an abuser who's been left. Because abusers are enraged and violently enraged when a relationship ends that they don't want to end. He believes in his right to rule. He believes in his right to have the last word. He believes in his right for that woman to wait on him hand and foot, and now she's had the gall to end her relationship with him. She must pay. Abusers already tend to have an overall orientation that children belong to them. It's not our kids, that's my kids. The father supremacy movement has fed these guys a lot. Now, I don't like the term father's rights because fathers should have rights just as mothers should and children should. Father's rights are a good thing. I'm a father. I think fathers should have rights. This movement has nothing to do with the legitimate rights of fathers. If you read their literature, which I have spent an unfortunate amount of time doing, the legitimate concerns of fathers hardly ever enter their discourse. Their discourse is about slamming women. Their discourse is about slamming allegations of domestic violence. It's about slamming disclosures of child sexual abuse. It's about slamming child support and child support collection. It's about talking about how destructive mothers are to children and how much healthier children do. They literally claim that children are that fathers are more important than mothers in whether children are going to come out well or not. So to call this a father's rights movement, to me, is like calling the Ku Klux Klan an equal rights for white people organization. And I know you heard quite a bit about male supremacists and father supremacists yesterday, so I'm not going to try to recover that ground. I think we've got to call them what they are. We've got to call them what they are, which is they're father supremacists, they're male supremacists. They believe that men should rule. They believe that fathers should have the last word. They have gotten a lot of mileage out of misrepresenting research about how incredibly destructive it is to children to not have fathers. That research has not controlled for class. As soon as you control for class, you discover that what's bad for kids is poverty, not fatherlessness. Children need good parents. They're better off with two good parents than with one. They're better off with three good parents than with two. They're better off with four good parents than with three, and so forth. I resent the notion that mothers cannot be adequate role models for their sons. Why can't my mother teach me how to be a man? Well, my mother couldn't have, but she wasn't much of a great parent. But there are plenty of mothers who end up being the role model for their sons of how to be an adult, how to be a man. There are plenty of fathers who have to raise their kids on their own and end up teaching their girls how to grow up to be women. We don't say, well, gee, a single father, he couldn't guide his girls into womanhood. We accept that, and we accept that it's sometimes done very, very well. But a mother, no, she's got to have a man around to help her boys become men. Why? What children need is good parents. They need good, loving parents, and as many of them as they can get. Unfortunately, these father supremacists have out-organized us at the grassroots. Even though they are a right-wing organization and they have explicitly made connections to the right wing consciously in a number of different ways, they've linked themselves to homophobic movements, they have linked themselves to pro-family movements that are really anti-choice and anti-feminist. At the same time, they've really borrowed a page from progressives and from the left wing and organized community by community, court by court, across the country. So what do I believe we need to do in order to fight back against the father supremacists and make sure that women are treated fairly in the custody system and that good, caring women, mothers, retain custody of their kids? Well, we've got to support the leadership of protective mothers, and we've got to support the leadership of women in general. And I certainly believe, and I understand there's been a lot of conversation about this, and I've heard this morning's, I missed yesterday, unfortunately, but I understand yesterday there was already a lot of talk about the importance, one of the big roles that those of us who are men have in the fight against violence against women is to support women's leadership, that's a lot of what we ought to be doing. And I think this is really, really critical in the custody movement, where part of why the father supremacists have been so successful is because they have built a movement that's largely led by the fathers, these particular fathers, the abusive fathers, themselves. And so in order to succeed, I believe, in fighting back, we've got to build a movement that's primarily led by the protective mothers themselves. The protective mothers is a term that's come to be used very widely now to mean a mother who's leaving an abuser and has been violent towards her, and she has to protect herself and her kids from this guy's established violence. Now, sometimes he's already also established that he's violent or sexually violating towards those kids. So we need to build a movement of protective mothers and their allies, and we really need men on board in that movement in a number of different ways, and I'll say a few things about that. But I wanted to say specifically, what do I believe does it mean real, very concretely to support women's leadership? And I'm thinking about supporting the leadership of protective mothers, but I'm thinking about it in a broader sense also. So what can we do? First of all, we need to show our faith in women as leaders. That means we need to communicate in the women that we're supporting in our lives our belief: you can do it. I know you can do it. I know you can lead successfully. If you're already leading, I know you can continue to succeed at what you're doing or whatever the new project is that you're taking on. I really believe you're going to bring that about and it's going to fly. Part of my job is to be there to shore up your confidence and say you can do it. In some ways, this is just switching roles from what women have been doing for us for, you know, centuries of saying, no, now it's our job to be the one that holds back a little bit sometimes and says, you know what, I'm going to be back here saying, go, 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 you can do it. To listen well, and we still got a long way to go on this, fellas. We're listening better than we were 20 years ago, but there's still so much interrupting, there's still so much taking up too much of the space, talking too long, offering analysis to women to help them understand their oppression. We need to listen, we need to validate, we need to say, yeah, I get what you're saying, that's in there, and we need to talk less. And yes, we have important contributions to make, but we gotta really watch how much of the space we're taking up. And we need to not dismiss obstacles. In other words, when women are struggling with questions of leadership and are saying, but I'm up against this and I'm up against this, it's not helpful when we say, oh, you'll get right past that, or oh, don't let them stop you. We become much more valuable allies when we actually get in there and think together. Oh, geez, that's a problem, isn't it? That's a really tricky obstacle. All right, how are we going to go after that? How, you know, let's think together. And that also means, of course, having to be very careful. Boy, am I talking fast, huh? That's what happens when you give me 30 minutes. We have to be very careful to be thinking with and not thinking for. In other words, keep advice to a minimum and try much more to be proposing different possibilities and working strategies and approaches out together. Strategize. Learn to strategize together. I think that's so often the role of any ally to people who are fighting for their liberation is to do good strategizing together. Help with financial resources. That was on my list, and then it came up a bunch this morning. If we want women's leadership to work, we're going to have to give their efforts money. And we're going to have to, some of it's going to have to come out of our own pockets, and some of it's going to have to come out of our organizations, and some of it's going to have to come out of how we contribute to helping raise that money. We need to check in periodically. We need to remember to, you know, 2 months later to give that phone call and say, so how's that project going? You know, how can I be behind you? What's up with that? How are you doing? What's getting hard? What's going well? We need to be prepared to accept critical feedback. You heard that already this morning, but I want to reiterate it again. As allies, and that means we've really got to stay out of ego. We can't be helpful we can't be very helpful if we're in an ego-bound place. We've got to be able to get past that. Women are not criticizing us because they hate us. If they hated us, they wouldn't bother with us. They're criticizing us because they think we're worth the effort. Consider it a compliment that you're being criticized. And that doesn't mean she's looking for you to come back going, I'm no good, like the dog, you know. It means she's looking for you to come back, take it in, do better, and get back out there and keep kicking butts. And then finally, I think it's important to try to work a lot to operate from a place that's where we get out of our heads a little bit, where we're not just coming from, well, I'm doing this because it's right, or I'm doing this because I have an analysis, or I'm doing this because I'm against this. But like, I'm doing this because, you know, think about what the kinds of things Eve Ensler was talking about this morning. I'm doing this because I hate this. You know, I hate what's being done, and I love human beings. And when you come from that kind of place, when you come from a kind of place where you're fighting this because you hate seeing this done to people and because you love people, I think that really affects what kind of ally you become. So that's my quick point by point on what I'd like to see us working on in being good allies to women and in supporting women's leadership. I've written an article that's specifically about supporting and developing the leadership of women in the custody rights movement, particularly mothers themselves, mothers with children who have their own custody litigation but also have political energy. One of the misconceptions that I hear is the notion that a woman who's in custody litigation, that's all she can do. She's just trying to survive to the end of her day. Well, maybe half the time that is true. She's so traumatized, she's broke, the system is jumping on her with both feet, and she is just trying to get through to the end of the day, and she's scared to death about what's going to happen to her kids. But I find that roughly the other half of women, yes, all those things are happening, and she nonetheless wants to be politically active. In fact, she wants to be politically active partly as a way to make the experience tolerable to her, because horrible traumatic experiences become somewhat more tolerable if you at least feel like you're managing to fight back against the system that's doing this. And so there's a lot of activist energy. When I get calls from women who are being, having their human rights so trampled by the family law system across the country, and I ask them, are you interested in also being sort of active in the cause in addition to looking for help with your own case? So much of the time they say, yes, show me where to plug in. I would love to be part of it in a political way. So we need to help court by court, community by community, protective mothers form their own organizations. I'm part of an organization called the Protective Mothers Alliance. For those of you who would like to get our newsletter,
or who would like to learn more about it, we're directed by, well, we're co-directed, but I'm really, because I'm called a co-director, but I'm really just the cheerleader. We're really primarily directed by a protective mother in Florida named Janice Levinson. Our number for anyone who wants to write it down is 941-822-5592. It's the Protective Mothers Alliance. We are also in the process of forming a specific arm of the Protective Mothers Alliance of fathers and stepfathers and other men. We're going to call it fathers and stepfathers, but feel free to join us if you don't have children, who want to commit themselves to being an outspoken voice for safe children and for abusers being stopped from using the custody litigation system as a way to continue their oppression of abused women. So if you're interested in being part of Fathers and Stepfathers for Protective Parenting, again, you can either talk to me, and I'll be around all day, or you can call the Protective Mothers Alliance telephone number and say that you would like to be part of that. Some other specific things that you can do, and I'm down to my last few minutes here. One is, whatever organization you're part of, please see if there's a way for you to put child custody on your organization's agenda. I don't believe we can ever get women free from domestic violence if leaving the abuser then just leads to her losing her children to him through the custody process. What that effectively means is that in many ways it's harder for a battered woman to leave now than it was 10 years ago. We're trying to make it easier for battered women to leave, and in many ways it's harder now than it was. Because these father supremacist organizations have pulled together, and they've pulled their lawyers together, and they've pulled their ideology together, and they've pulled their psychologists together and their websites together, and they're all, and they've got so many judges on board now with parental alienation. I mean, parental alienation has just become part of the language. I mean, it's hardly any abuser now fails to accuse of parental alienation. They all know now that that's the way to go. Some other places that you can plug in include Stop Family Violence, and Irene Weiser is here, and the National Coalition Against Domestic Violence, that have projects looking specifically at child custody. For people who are in their teens or young 20s who grew up in any way exposed to child custody litigation that was being driven by an abuser, there's two organizations. There's Hear Us Now and the Courageous Kids Network. So if you know young people who'd like to speak publicly or organize publicly about what it was like that their father was abusing through the custody system, please put them in touch with us. We need to adopt the language of human rights, because what I think of when I see children taken away from moms, I think of slavery. This is what it takes me back to, because that's the immediate images I get of situations where children could just be taken away from their parents. I mean, women now are having a double whammy, because while they're with the abuser, the child welfare system is taking their kids away from them, and then they get away from him, and he's taking their children away from him. Sometimes, by the way, on the same case. In other words, sometimes the same time that child welfare was in there telling her, because this guy is so bad, you're a bad mother, but then she leaves him, and that same case, he ends up with custody through the family law system. I was just reviewing the details of a case where child welfare got involved because of the domestic violence. That's why they were involved, was because of the violence that the children were being exposed to by the batterer's behavior towards mom. Mom didn't quite go through all the steps that child welfare demanded that she go through. Dad did. He did his batterer program and all the stuff he was supposed to do. So child welfare gave custody to him. Child welfare, this was in Massachusetts, child welfare said, well, he's done the things he was supposed to do, and you haven't done all the things that you were supposed to do. Wait a minute. This case was opened because of his violence, but because he was, but I don't have to say anything more about that, do I? Okay. In closing, two last points. One is there were some important things said about research. So I want to throw in for anyone who's got academic connections or research involvement. We were talking about the lack of research available to go to issues relating to what's being done to women. There's an incredible absence of research on what batterers are doing after couples split up. and about what's happening to women and children in domestic violence cases when they're not with the batterer anymore. And that's one of the things that's making it harder for us to make certain kinds of arguments in court because we don't have the research. So any of you who are in research or connected to researchers, we really need post-separation research on domestic violence. There's a huge shortage. Except for the homicide research, there's almost no other post-separation-oriented research on domestic violence. And then finally, what I want to say is, part of how the father supremacists have had so much success is by calling themselves fathers' organizations. They obviously don't call themselves abusers' organizations. They wouldn't get very far with that. And being slick and dishonest, the way abusers are, as I've been talking about for years, and manipulative, they call themselves fathers. And they call their organizations fathers' organizations. And so that they've set it up so that they are the male voice, and they are the voice of fathers. So that I've talked to journalists who say, well, I can't really, this article wouldn't be balanced if I didn't also call the Fathers' Rights Organization and get a comment from them. It's like, oh, so when you're doing an article on drunk driving, you feel like it would be imbalanced unless you first interviewed someone who'd killed some people drunk, or your article somehow would be imbalanced. But this is what they've set up. They've set up where they're the voice of fathers. So that's one of the things we've got to stop. And so we've got to form strong fathers' organizations that are fathers in support of protective mothers, that are fathers in support of safe children, that are fathers against domestic violence and against child abuse, fathers that are for safe children. And if you want to connect with our fathers' organization, and again, any men, fathers or not, with our fathers' organization through the Protective Mothers Alliance, do that. If you don't want to do that way, create your own. We'll support you to create your own. But we have to start being visible publicly as fathers, as men and as fathers, who are in favor of safe children, in favor of protective parenting, and against the atrocity of taking children away from their loving, caring moms. Thanks very much.
Thank you for joining Prevent Connect Audio. Prevent Connect Audio is a project of the California Coalition Against Sexual Assault, with funding from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The views presented on Prevent Connect Audio are not necessarily the views of the United States government, the CDC, or CalCASA. You can contact us at info@preventconnect.org, or you can learn much more on our website at www.preventconnect.org.